From Kentucky to New Mexico, Louisiana to North Dakota, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the national lockdown to slow the spread of the Wuhan coronavirus is scheduled to end April 30th. But how will we know when it's safe to begin restarting the economy? Lieutenant General Tom Spohr of the Heritage Foundation is here with the answer. Both the Federal Reserve and Congress are taking action to prop up the U.S. economy now reeling from the impact of the coronavirus. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Simon Lester of the Cato Institute about why export bans are further weighing down the economy. And researchers at the University of Pittsburgh say they have developed a vaccine against the COVID-19 coronavirus. Dr. Paul Kangor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The U.S. military has been instrumental in the effort to deal with the medical impact of the coronavirus. But has the fight against the disease impacted the nation's military preparedness? Lieutenant General Tom Spohr is director of the Heritage Foundation Center for National Defense. He joins us to discuss. General, welcome to American Radio Journal. General, as we look to the national response that has been taking place to the COVID-19 coronavirus crisis, we see that the president has been able to deploy the military in a number of different ways. Can you talk for a few minutes about the way the Defense Department has been able to contribute to this national response?
And the military provides a well-trained, well-disciplined, available force that's really able to move and take action with very short notice compared to the private sector and other organizations. And so they provide a wide variety of capabilities, anything from engineering support. You've seen the Corps of Engineers taking the Javits Convention Center and making a hospital out of it. You've seen the Army deploying their field hospitals. These are usually tactical hospitals that can be set up in a field. In this case, they're setting them up in major cities like Dallas, like New York City. You've seen the Navy move their two 1,000-bed hospital ships to both Los Angeles and New York City, again, to provide backup hospital support. And then you've really seen the National Guard get mobilized today. I think they have 27,000 National Guardsmen, and these National Guardsmen are operating at the state level under the control of their governors, and they're running mobile test sites. They're handing out food and food banks. They're helping governors and local authorities administer their stay-at-home policy. So the military is really able to provide a lot of capability during this difficult time.
Biological warfare is something that the military prepares for, prepares to defend against. Are there lessons to be learned by civilians in how the military has prepared for biological warfare in dealing with the spread of the coronavirus?
Well, absolutely. So a biological weapon and a biological agent like the coronavirus at the point of impact really look the same. And so there is no difference between something that's been prepared deliberately as a weapon and something that is just kind of destined upon us by Mother Nature. And so the same techniques of infection control, proper hygiene, washing your hands, using protective gear such as masks and suits and gloves, we practice all that in the military. We think about it, at least in my former profession as an Army Chemical Corps officer, we trained and thought about it a lot. So, yeah, there's a lot of similarity. You know, a lot of people in the military have that as part of their training.
We see that, as you've mentioned, the military is very actively engaged in dealing with the coronavirus pandemic that we have going on here in the country, Tom. How does this impact the nation's readiness globally to defend the country? Because just because we have a pandemic doesn't mean we don't have enemies that can be plotting against us.
Yeah, I'm not going to say it will not and has not had an impact. Training programs, major exercises have been forced to be canceled. We learned just the other day that the Army has had to pause its basic training so that they are no longer currently shipping people from the recruiting stations to basic training sites. So it's going to cause a bit of a gap, a depression, I guess you'd say, in readiness. Having said that, 99% of the military is under 50 years of age, and they usually come without any complicating health factors. They're all in fairly good physical shape. So the actual visible and impact on service members is going to be low. They're not going to suffer the same effects that the general population is going to have. So presuming that the pandemic is over late summer, I would think by late fall, the military will be back essentially to where they were before this happened.
Speaking then of the pandemic becoming over, everybody, of course, is very anxious to get back to what was the normal way of life. That's going to take some time. How are we going to be able to determine when we're going to be able to start resuming a lot of these normal activities? We look at numbers. We're just about at peak, or what everybody thinks is going to be peak right now. What factors do we have to see before we can start loosening up on a lot of the social distancing restrictions, start reopening businesses, et cetera?
For me, it comes down to about four different things. You mentioned numbers. We have to see that the rates of new infections, the death rate, and the rate of hospitalizations is going down. If it's still going up, it makes no sense to even think about relaxing any of our current restrictions. As everyone is talking about in the media, we need better testing. We need testing that is not just for those that present themselves to a hospital saying they're sick, but we need a better sense of what's out there bubbling in the population. What is the general rate of infection in our population? And even better than that would be to start testing to see who is immune. So those people that test and show that they're immune can go back to work fairly quickly. We need our hospital system to be as resilient as it can be, and so we need to start getting and receiving some of these masks that you hear about the government producing and the ventilators. So we need our ICUs be as well equipped as we can. And then finally, we would optimally like to see some progress either on a vaccine or on a therapeutic, some drug or treatment, course of treatment that actually shows some promise of being able to alleviate the COVID disease. If we see progress, and then there doesn't have to be progress in all four of those areas I just mentioned, but we need to see progress across the board in some of those areas before we can start relaxing.
Is this going to be a situation where we're not going to just throw a switch and all of a sudden everything's going to be back to the way it was, but that we might see different restrictions removed in different parts of the country based upon how hard hit they've been by this virus?
I think it's almost certain that we'll see something like that. And so, and that can take numerous different forms. Like it can be a regional approach. So right now I'm in Northern Virginia, but I'm within a mile of Maryland, so it would make sense to treat those two areas as a group and not just do a strict state by state, because we are so close and there's so much travel in between Virginia and Maryland, for example. So that would be a regional approach. You could do a by-risk group approach, and so you could say those that are at the highest risk of complications from COVID, those that are older, those that have chronic conditions, you must stay in, but those that are not of high risk, you can be more free with your activity and release social distancing. And then you could even say some specific sectors of industry, if they are less, so maybe the auto workers, maybe they could go back, or some other factory or segment of our industry where it's not like a restaurant industry where everybody's packed in together. If there's an ability to bring them back, you could bring them back. So this returning to normal will probably take a very gradual and a very nuanced approach, I would think.
We have been talking with Lieutenant General Tom Spohr, who is the director of the Center for National Defense at the Heritage Foundation. And Tom, tell us a little bit about Heritage. Also, where can folks go online to read more about you?
Heritage is a member-supported foundation that takes a lot of different, conducts research in a lot of different areas of public policy, and including education, healthcare, economics, and then my area, obviously defense and public health. We have published and are publishing a number of products about this emergency that we're in. You can find them all at heritage.org.
Lieutenant General Tom Spohr, General, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, sir.
Scott Parkinson works for the Club for Growth, working from home these days, joining us every week here on American Radio Journal. Scott, good to have you back with us.
Thank you, Loman.
A number of federal government actions taking place over the last few days. Let's start out, Scott, talking about the Federal Reserve, its taking some additional steps to try to fortify the economy. Tell us what's up.
Federal Reserve obviously tries to operate as an independent entity. I think that you're seeing a little bit of pressure on them to act. And so this week they made two announcements, pretty large announcements. The first was that they would try to provide $600 billion worth of loans through a new program they're calling the Main Street Lending Program. And then in addition to that, they're going to try to pump $500 billion in lending to states and municipalities through another program that they're calling the Municipal Liquidity Facility. $1.1 trillion of action through the Federal Reserve this week is obviously an enormous amount of money. And we'll see exactly what kind of an effect that that has going forward. But I think that what we've learned here over the last 3 weeks, Loman, is that as much money as you throw at the problem, unless you can solve the problem without money, it's not really going to solve anything.
Yes, the virus continues to be a major medical problem as we simultaneously grapple with these economic issues. Congress is looking at some additional action as well.
Yeah, this week you saw Congress come around the idea that the Paycheck Protection Program, PPP, was going to run out of money quicker than they had estimated when they passed the CARES Act, which included several hundred billion dollars of lending for small businesses. And so you saw Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi going back and forth over how much money to try to pass by unanimous consent through Congress. Mitch McConnell wanted to do $250 billion in direct lending to small businesses through the Paycheck Protection Program, while Pelosi and Schumer wanted to have additional spending items for states and municipalities. They wanted to have money for frontline workers related to health security. And of course, they wanted to check every box in terms of identity politics when they deliver money out the door, having certain quotas met for various demographics. So that was quite a debate this week. And of course, like I said, most members of Congress aren't even in Washington unless they live here full time. And that's news to many of their constituents. But it really just hasn't done anything to stop the bleeding in terms of what the American employer is doing with its employees. This week, we also saw 6.26 million new jobless claims. That brings us to a total of over 16.6 million jobless claims in just 3 weeks. I mean, right now, the American worker is totally suffering through the coronavirus more than the virus itself. I think that a couple weeks ago, President Trump said we can't let the cure be worse than the disease, but certainly the economic impact is going to be felt for a long time here. Hopefully we can speed up to a quick recovery. And of course, Club for Growth has a lot of policy ideas on how to do that.
Speaking of those policy ideas, this past week, the club came out with a policy paper talking about ways that we can, among other things, do deregulation in an effort to get the economy going.
Even before the coronavirus epidemic, it was understood that federal regulations impose a staggering burden on the economy and reduce the number of jobs that the American businesses can create. In 2019, the total cost of regulation on the U.S. economy was estimated by the Competitive Enterprise Institute to be $1.9 trillion. Well, of course, now after we've done $2.2 trillion here and you're seeing the Fed Reserve do $1.1 trillion this week, those numbers don't seem very big, but trust me, they are astronomical. They are so big and large. And that's what the cost of regulation really means for job creators, risk takers, and entrepreneurs. What we're basically seeing here, we have, according to the Small Business Administration, we have 59.9 million small business workers. And when you account for that being about 47.3% of the workforce, it yields about $15,000 per employee for the average cost of regulation on small business. So what we want to do is be a part of the policy solution. We've been working with our allies in the House and Senate and, of course, in the executive branch in the White House. And we believe that there should be specific proposals that Congress should consider in order to relieve the burden of regulation on job creators. So first, we think that Congress should immediately pass legislation providing for all administrative agencies to waive any federal regulation that imposes a burden on American businesses, charities, educational institutions, or other employers. In order to expedite the economic recovery, we think the legislation should immediately suspend all regulations. While doing so, will reduce costs and assist in the economic recovery and increase private sector employment opportunities. Every administrative agency should be required within just 1 month to identify and suspend these significant regulations. And we think that that will help when the economy is ready to be reignited and get Americans back into the workforce. So we think that if the president approves the waiving of these regulations, that they should be suspended until the president and Congress determine that the suspension is no longer needed to provide for relief from the economic crisis. And then we would go into a notice and comment period and other Administrative Procedures Act provisions to determine whether or not we should reestablish those regulations and bring them back as another obstacle to employment in the future. We think that the president should also issue an administrative order, an executive order, pursuant to his duty in Article 2, requiring each administrative agency to suspend civil and criminal penalties for any violation of federal regulations when the person has made what's called a good faith effort to comply. So in many instances, people think that they're complying with regulation. Big government sweeps in and says, here's a large fine because we don't think you've been complying with this regulation related to the water on your farming land. So we think if there's a good faith effort, that should be totally waived.
Scott, tell us a bit about the Club for Growth and also give us the website where this new paper can be read.
The website is www.clubforgrowth.org. And the Club for Growth is a membership organization based in Washington, D.C. And our members are united in this idea of freedom, economic liberty. And we encourage everybody, if they're interested, just to check us out. Our Twitter handle is also at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you. We'll check in next week.
Okay, thanks.
At first glance, some export bans made sense. But as the economy struggles with the coronavirus pandemic, are they hurting more than they help? For the answer, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine turns to Simon Lester from the Cato Institute.
The United States is now joining dozens of other countries around the world in implementing restrictions on the export of medical gear and supplies in response to the coronavirus. On one level, that makes a degree of sense. We need those supplies here. But on another level, that's just going to make the entire crisis worse. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Simon Lester. He is the associate director of the Hubert Stifel Center for Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. And he joins us now on the phone from self-isolation, as we all are. Simon, thanks for taking some time out of your self-quarantine to join us here on the program.
Good to be here with you, Eric.
Simon, let's start with the news here, which is that on Wednesday, FEMA and the Border Patrol put out a joint statement saying that they are going to detain shipments of PPE. That's the personal protective equipment, medical equipment, things like masks and gloves and all of that. They are going to detain those shipments in accordance with a recent order from President Donald Trump, while FEMA determines if that PPE should stay here inside the United States or if it can be exported abroad. This seems like kind of a big deal. I know lots of other countries are doing similar things right now, but unpack this order for us a bit, if you can. How significant is this?
This is significant. So this idea of export restrictions has been trending recently. And so there's a guy named Simon Evenet, an economist, who tracks these things. And by his count, I think we have 70 countries now who have imposed export restrictions on various medical supplies. The U.S. was a little late to the party, but as you pointed out, the Trump administration is now pushing forward with its own export restriction, and one that looks like it could be pretty powerful. It could be pretty restrictive. There's a temporary final rule that FEMA issued yesterday. I think it goes into effect tomorrow, April 10th, and it looks like it gives FEMA a lot of power to prevent the export of these PPE products. It also gives them discretion not to, and that's what's confusing about this is we don't know how it's going to be applied. In theory, they could take this, and each time they get a batch of surgical masks, they could say, nope, sorry, we need these here in the United States. They're not going anywhere. Or they could say, you know what, actually, this is something that's been contracted for a long time ago. we're going to let it all go through. And there are some criteria set out in this rule, and they could be applied in different ways. So it has the potential to be a really throw off international trade and international relations, but it also could just be something FEMA, you know, does as a rubber stamp.
You mentioned that something like 70 other countries now have some form of export ban in place. We've heard a lot about India cutting off exports of some of their drugs. As I said at the beginning, on one level, this makes a degree of sense to me. I can understand why policymakers might be looking around and saying, hey, we don't have enough of this stuff to deal with the crisis in our own country. We can't be sending some of this abroad. At the same time, though, I mean, this is a global crisis. It's a pandemic. And we have global supply chains. It really does require a global response. So this idea that, hey, we need to keep our own stuff here, that really only works until everybody else stops sending their stuff here too, right?
Yeah, I mean, the instinct is certainly understandable. I mean, each government's accountable to some extent to their citizens. And if they had these products on hand and they left them out of the country, you can see the citizens saying, wait a minute, what are you doing? You're supposed to take care of us. When the election comes along, maybe we're going to vote for the other party. But I think if you think beyond sort of it's not just a single decision by one government. It's a whole bunch of different governments who all have to interact with each other in different ways. I mean, everybody's importing and exporting these products. If we, the United States, restrict our exports, then other countries who might be exporting to us might restrict their exports to the United States. So we might be helped by our own export restrictions, but we'll be hurt by somebody else's retaliation. So I think as sort of a monitoring mechanism to make sure we know where all the products are, these sort of export regulations make sense. We want to keep track of everything and know where the stuff is and get it to the people who need it the most. But I think the alternative and better approach to all of this is all the governments need to get together and see how they can encourage more production of this and then coordinate as to who needs the stuff the most. I mean, countries are going through this crisis at different schedules. Some people are at their peak, some people are not. I think most people would agree that it makes sense to really focus on the areas who are in the most desperate need. And that could be particular countries or particular regions within a country. So, you know, here in the United States, we've got New York City or Louisiana or Albany, Georgia, who are getting hit the hardest. Let's get all the equipment from other parts of the United States or other countries who aren't feeling it as badly and get it to those regions. Or, you know, when Milan was getting crushed, let's get all the stuff to them. So I think that rather than push export restrictions too far, we should focus more on increasing production and trading and, you know, coordinating to help the people who need it most.
We are talking with Simon Lester. He is the Associate Director of the Cato Institute's Center for Trade Policy Studies. Simon, just about a minute left here, but I guess, and you kind of touched on this already, but the only solution here is just more production everywhere, right? Like everybody just needs to be making more of everything right now.
Let's make all we can. We can't really overproduce here. If we do, put it in a stockpile for the next time. So yeah, there's no risk here, I think, in just everybody producing all that they can. It will be used at some point over the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years. So just make everything we can. Overproduce this stuff right now. That's my recommendation.
Yeah, make all of it. 3M, for example, I know that they say that they've doubled their production of masks since January, and now they're on pace to actually double it again in the next couple of months. That's great news. Obviously, it means the market is responding, but then you also have to be able to get those masks to wherever they are needed. That is key, and these export restrictions, they get in the way of that, and who knows how this crisis is going to evolve and where those masks are going to need to go in the next few months. Unfortunately, we are out of time for today. That is Simon Lester from the Cato Institute. Simon, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And again, that is Simon Lester. He is the Associate Director of the Cato Institute Center for Trade Policy Studies. Check out his work at cato.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can follow everything that we are covering relating to the coronavirus and the government's response to it at reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Researchers at the University of Pittsburgh developed the vaccine that ended the polio epidemic. Have they done so in the fight against the coronavirus? Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College talks about it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Polio is conquered. That was the jubilant headline across newspapers nationwide on April 12, 1955, 65 years ago this month. The man who did it, Dr. Jonas Salk. As America and the world in great anxiety observed the rising toll of COVID-19 victims, I've personally thought a number of times about Dr. Salk. Back when I was a pre-med student some 30 years ago, I daily walked by Salk Hall at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Fittingly, the nondescript edifice was constructed on the site of what was originally the Pittsburgh Municipal Hospital for Contagious Diseases, which was precisely the enemy with which Salk locked horns in Mortal Kombat from a laboratory in the basement. Polio, as older folks will remember, was one of humanity's most malicious scourges. Parents trembled in fear of the disease, commonly and dreadfully known as infantile paralysis, even though it affected adults as well. By the early 1950s, the nation was experiencing about 20,000 cases per year, and in 1952, America suffered its worst polio outbreak ever. A nation cried out for help, and Dr. Jonas Salk stepped up. In July 1952, Salk initiated at the University of Pittsburgh his first clinical trial. He injected 43 children with his vaccine, and then a few weeks later injected himself and his own children. And guess what? Not one got polio. What they did get were elevated levels of crucial polio-fighting antibodies. That was the goal. And then with that, a larger clinical trial would ramp up in the summer of 1954, with desperate parents volunteering 2 million of their children to receive the experimental inoculation. The results? They were disclosed to the world at a dramatic news conference on April 12, 1955. The Salk vaccine worked. Imagine the relief. Can it happen again, this time with COVID-19? Well, actually, quite remarkably, it may be happening again, and once again at the University of Pittsburgh. On April 2nd, researchers at Pitt Medical School and the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center made global headlines when they held a press conference announcing the first major candidate for a COVID-19 vaccine. Pitt's researchers published their results in the April 2nd issue of eBioMedicine. That's the online version of the longtime excellent British medical journal, The Lancet. This is a big deal, and it could be the real deal. How did Pitt possibly pull this off so quickly? Well, according to Dr. Andrea Gambotto, one of the lead researchers, quote, "We had previous experience on SARS coronavirus in 2003 and MERS coronavirus in 2014. We knew exactly where to fight this new virus," unquote. When the genetic sequencing for the current COVID-19 virus was identified in January, notes Dr. Gambotto, they were able to plug in to their existing framework and rapidly produce a vaccine. The vaccine is being called PITT-COVAC. The authors are in the process of securing FDA approval to launch a Phase 1 human clinical trial within the next few months. Well, yes, a few months. Of course, there's an obvious urgency now. Quite fittingly, Dr. Phalo, one of the two researchers involved in the report, points to Dr. Jonas Salk. Phalo actually opened the April 2nd press conference at Pitt by heralding Jonas Salk's breakthrough there in April 1955. He said, quote, "This is the same place where Dr. Jonas Salk invented the polio vaccine 65 years ago." Precisely. That was 65 years ago this month. Can University of Pittsburgh researchers do it again? And how quickly can this vaccine get approved and put into use? For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, KOFEAM in St. Mary's, Idaho. Welcome to our new listeners in the Gem State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.